Accession number 18837, Reel 2.
John Stokes, Reel 2.
They got down to roughly their previous front line. We had a miserable time. We had a lot of sandstorms. And it came out afterwards that we were on the move, and we was trying to find Rommel. Rommel was trying to find us. But I think, fortunately for us, he never found us. I won't say it was fortunate for him or not. I don't know. But basically, it was a very miserable time, and the weather changed, and we were getting a lot of sandstorms, sand in everything, in our food, in our drinking waters, everywhere. We were just holding the line, and we were then withdrawn from the desert and hustled down to the canal zone and told that we were going to the island of Crete. Now, Crete had been occupied by the Germans, and our troops had been trying to stop them, and we were, some of our brigade had gone already, but we were put onto a merchant ship, and we were told that we were going to land on Crete. I'm going to read. Yes. Okay. So the position was that the 2nd Battalion of the Queen's embarked for the island on the 22nd of May. The other two brigades, battalions of the brigade, had gone on previously. The ship we travelled on was HMS Glenroy, a landing ship equipped with special boats to get us ashore. We were escorted by HMS Coventry, an anti-aircraft cruiser, and another escort vessel. As soon as we were at sea, we were given details of the task we were expected to do when we landed. Because our naval losses had been so heavy after the fall of Greece, most naval forces, except our ship and escort, were ordered to retire to harbour during the night of the 22nd, 23rd of May. We were attacked from the air at 11 a.m. the next morning, and because of frequent air alerts, at 3 o'clock we were ordered to return to harbour. To say that we were relieved is putting it mildly, because an air attack at sea is very frightening. We disembarked at Alexandria in the early morning of May the 25th and eventually got on the train, much to our delight. However, we did not leave the station, and later we were told that because of a critical position in Crete, another try had to be made to reach the island. We re-embarked on the Glenroy at 11 o'clock and sailed again for Crete in the evening. A naval escort was the cruiser Coventry and destroyer Stuart and Jaguar. Because the next 2 days are so traumatic, maybe I can quote verbatim from the History of the Queen's Royal Regiment by Major Foster, Chapter 7. So I quote, "At 5 p.m. on May the 26th, 1941, an enemy reconnaissance plane dropped 2 sticks of bombs without causing damage. But an hour later, the convoy, and especially the Glenroy, was heavily attacked by about 12 German bombers. There was tremendous anti-aircraft fire from the escort and from the 36 light machine guns, Bren guns, manned by the battalion on the Glenroy. But in spite of it, the attack was most determinedly carried out by shallow dive bombing, mainly directed at the landing ship Glenroy. There were many near misses, and at each the ship shuddered and the decks were drenched with water. It was the battalion's first experience of bombing on a ship and at sea, and to them it seemed impossible that the Glenroy could survive. Early in the action, a splinter from a near miss set fire to the large dump of cans of petrol stored on deck. A firefighting party, including officers and men of the Queen's, worked with the greatest courage and devotion, forming a chain from the blazing dump and hurling the 2-gallon cans into the sea. Meanwhile, the light machine gunners and their servers, equally gallant, maintained their fire without ceasing, even when the fires from the blazing petrol almost reached them. The conditions for the rest of the battalion below decks was almost more trying. They had no activity to distract them and could only sit and listen to the appalling noise around them. But the men were magnificent, and the officers had no difficulty at all in keeping them calm. The attack only lasted a little over an hour, though it seemed never-ending. After final low-level torpedo attack, the planes drew off, the fire was extinguished, and it was possible to assess the damage. One landing craft had been destroyed and 3 others were damaged. One man of the Queen's had been killed and 9 wounded. And that is the end of the quote. I might say at this stage that I was one of those below decks, and believe me, it was very bad. So because of the attack on the Glenroy, the convoy was delayed, also our landing craft had been damaged, and therefore any chance of getting to Crete being effective was diminished. So we were ordered back to Alexandra. On the way back we were shattered by aircraft, and 2 more sticks of bombs were dropped, but our ship wasn't damaged. I witnessed a sad ceremony on the way back. The Queen's soldier killed in the air attack was buried at sea. We arrived back at Alexandra on the evening of the 27th of May, and we disembarked the next morning and went back to camp at Amaria. We heard later that Crete was evacuated from the 27th of May onwards. About 15,000 out of the 27,000 defenders got away with great difficulty, and the other 2 battalions of the 16th Brigade, who had landed before our attempt to land, the 1st Argyles and the 2nd Esters, suffered very heavily. My feelings were that although our experience of being shut down in a hole during the air attack was pretty awful, at least we survived and were lucky not to have landed on Crete. It emerged later that if we had landed on Crete, 50% casualties were expected. Having once more arrived at the staging camp at Amaria, we waited for the next move, which was in fact on the 8th of June, when the 2nd Queen's, together with the rest of the 16th Brigade, moved to Kassassin, a great training camp in the Suez Canal area. We expected to stay there some time, but on the 12th of June we were put on trains and arrived at Tul Karm in Palestine, now Israel, and marched into camp at Beit Lid. Now I must put you in the picture, to use an army expression, regarding the developing situation in Syria, which is north of Palestine. Right, so where we are. So now we've been sent up to Syria. Now, Syria was a colony of the French. And after the fall of France, of course, we had lots of French people. There were the Free French, who were on our side. There was the Vichy French, who were on the German side. Now, the Vichy French were in charge in Syria, and they let the Germans use airfields. So they had to be got out. So they decided to use us. We were part of the force, which was put up in order to try and persuade the French to pack it in, but they didn't pack it in, and so we virtually had to fight every inch of the way, and we had to go up through the mountains, through the mountains of what they call the Merjum, and I think it's roughly round about the Golan Heights area they talk about in that present day Syria, but it was mountains, and the French were waiting for us. The actual territory we passed over, we couldn't understand it because they were shelling us, and we were hiding behind piles of stones, and they were shelling us the stones away. And it turned out that it in fact was an artillery range of the French, and we were being obviously shot at because they had the complete range. But the conditions were awful. We couldn't get our food up, we couldn't get our water up, we were desperately tired. At one stage we were moving up at night in transport, and we'd been on the go for hours, and the drivers also, and their driver fell asleep, hit a boulder and turned the lorry over down the mountainside, and we clambered out. We thought, oh good, we shan't be going into action, but our officer, he decided otherwise, and so we marched in and went into action. But the actual conditions, to some extent, were far worse than the desert, because we thought it was going to be a walkover, and it wasn't. We were ill prepared for what was virtually mountain warfare, and we were getting casualties. And in fact, at one stage, my platoon was down to about half a dozen fellows and an officer. And it was so dire physically that I must have collapsed in a little position up in the mountains, because I turned up in a casualty clearing station in Damascus without any, just from the clothes I stood up in, and on medical examination they said that I was suffering from anxiety state, and from then on I was moved down through Transjordan down to Jerusalem. And then sent to a psychiatric hospital in a place called Sarafand. The journey from Damascus down to Jerusalem was pretty awful, considering our mental state, because I was in company with quite a number of other fellows in a similar mental and physical exhaustion. But the because of the troubles in Palestine, the Jewish people weren't at all friendly towards us British troops, and the road that goes down to Jerusalem from Jordan, and he went into army parlance like the clappers of hell in this bus, and we were absolutely petrified. And it was sort of a typical of the attitude. As a matter of fact, the Arabs were far better, far more disposed to us than the Jews were, which is a bit ironical because we'd made a home for the Jews in Palestine. But I was put into this psychiatric hospital. We were on at a very easygoing time. The doctors were good, they just explained to us that we were there for rest. We'd overdone things a bit, and all would be well. So we were sort of given a bit of competence, but nothing along the lines of counselling or anything like that. It was really kindness. The reason, of course, I was in this hospital was, as I said earlier, I was suffering from what they called anxiety state. Now, anxiety state is a fact, I think, that when one's mental and physical powers are completely exhausted, you can put up with a certain amount of discomfort, but if you have had shock, if you've been very badly frightened, and you at the same time are physically tired, it has a much more serious effect on you. Now, we aren't all made alike. Some of the fellows could cope quite well. Maybe I was a bit emotional, over-emotional. I don't know, maybe I was too sensitive for an infantry soldier. But I can remember up in the mountains, my last really thoughts were, is this the end of it? You know, is this a way it's just going to fade away? We're not going to get out of this. We're stuck. And maybe I was sort of rescued by, my sanity was rescued by going unconscious or something. I don't know, and I've never able to find out how I got from off the mountains down into the casualty clearing station. I've got no memory at all. Because we'd been on the move for hours and hours. We'd had no sleep and no food. The situation was, the food was being brought up so far, but we couldn't get at the food because it was dumped in the valley. And if anybody went after it, the French would machine gun us. If one man went round, they'd get machine guns out. If more than one man went round, it would be mortars or artillery. So we could see the food down there. We couldn't get at it. And I think the whole thing just got too much for us. Well, for me anyway. We'd lost some fellows, but I think a lot of the other fellows weren't necessarily physically wounded, but they were in a bad state. The whole battalion was what I would term ragged. We'd been on the move, we'd done this job, we'd done that, we'd had the experience on board the Glenroy, and then before we got caught our breath, we were into this. And I found it's just too much to cope. And I think that fellows reacted different ways. In the 23rd Scottish General Hospital, which was a psychiatric hospital, we had even Cypriots. Some of the air transport was driven by Greek Cypriots, and they were having lumbar punches. But I was only given sedatives, and I must say that I was more relaxed but numb. I just sort of just couldn't relate to the situation at all. I think I was thankful to have a rest, but I was still couldn't quite relate. But once my sort of treatment, and I was sent off to convalescent camp. Now that was a beautiful place by the seaside in Palestine. We were on double rations, plenty of food, relaxed, no parades, we just got on, and the idea was that they were going to feed us up ready for further action. But we gradually got better. But personally, I'm afraid we had orange groves near us. They grow a lot of oranges in Palestine, and unfortunately I got malaria. So I was put into the camp hospital and given quinine. So I had this malaria, and they gave me a lot of quinine, and then I was getting better, went, carried on, and then I had a relapse of malaria and given another lot of quinine. And the doctor said, "Well, son, you want one thing, you'll never get malaria again because you've had two lots of them." But I wasn't 100%. I didn't seem to make much progress, and eventually they diagnosed me as having jaundice. And that was brought on by the quinine, evidently. But the treatment was a bit dire. I had Epsom salts night and morning, Marmite on toast, and Marmite to drink. And believe me, that after a week or so, I was 100%. And I was sent off and rejoined my battalion down in the canal zone in December. Okay? There was one experience in the convalescent camp which is maybe unique, I don't know, but having, I suppose, looked death in the eye quite a bit, I was rather interested in taking Holy Communion. And a chaplain was quite willing to do it, but there was a problem, because he was Church of England, and you had to be of the Church of England faith to be eligible for having communion. Well, I was brought up as chapel, my parents were chapel, and so I was ruled out. But the padre said to me, "Well," he said, "I can always baptize you, you see." So I said, "Oh yes, all right." Well, I thought about it, but anyway, he was quite a nice fellow, and as a matter of fact, he took us on outings to Palestine. You know, we went to Jerusalem and saw the holy places and so on. He was a nice chap, really. So I was convinced, and so I was christened into the Church of England in Palestine, and I've got a certificate at home to prove the fact. And then I was prepared for confirmation, and he said, "Well, I can give you communion now, but we'll get your confirmation done later on." And anticipating, I didn't stay there long enough to get confirmed, but I was eventually confirmed in Ceylon. So I suppose really I'm a member of the Church of Ceylon. That's it for a bit. So in December, I rejoined the Queen's, and actually the second battalion of the Queen's. But I was being quite fortunate, because while I was in hospital, they in fact had formed part of the garrison of Tobruk, and that in itself was an experience. And so I feel that I was indeed fortunate to not to have been with the battalion, because they had a terrible time in Tobruk, and they had quite a lot of casualties, and the conditions were pretty awful. But I rejoined them and picked up threads. We'd had a lot of reinforcements come from. You could always tell reinforcements because I had white knees and we had that. And of course I joined up with my particular friend Alan Mattingly. You'll probably hear more about him as time goes on. Believe it or not, they sent us up into Syria, where we formed the garrison. And we were up on the Turkish frontier, and we were actually in battle dress, which was a winter clothing. And while we were up there, We hadn't been up there very long, and then there was panic stations, and they said, oh, well, we're getting on trains, you know, and we were put onto trains, French trains, they were cattle trucks, and they hadn't long taken the cattle out of them. And so we travelled down, and of course as we got down near the canal zone, so we got hotter and the smell got worse. But when we got there, we went into a big camp, and it was really a master of organisation. We were told then that we were going to the Far East because the Japanese had come into the war. And so they wanted some experienced troops. But the way it was done, it was the organization of an infantry battalion at its best. We had huge marquees, and we walked into these marquees in battle dress and walked out the other end in tropical uniform again. You know, and all the usual thing, bayonets were sharpened and the armors looked to their rifles, and so we knew we were on it. And so there we were, off we were going onto pastures new. And but before we left camp, Sergeant Major sent for me, and he said, I've got a nice little job for you on the voyage. He said, you've had a rough time a bit. And he said, how would you like a cushy number? I said, I'm all for a cushy number, you see. And so he said, we've got an officer who's travelling with us. He's going to a staff job at our destination. Nobody knew where our destination was at that stage. But he said, you're going to be his batman. I said, well, what am I going to do then? Oh, he said, just look after him on the boat, that's all. And which I did, and he was a Captain Spencer Smith of the Hampshire Regiment, a nice chap, and I used to clean his buttons and his sandbag belt and made sure that and so it was a real nice trip. We were on a Dutch boat, the New Amsterdam, brand new boat, but of course the Dutch were on our side, and I think it's done its maiden voyage. But we had no escort. We just relied on air speed, and away we went across the Indian Ocean. I think we had whispers that we were going to Rangoon, but we weren't sure. But anyway, we docked somewhere. And we looked all around, and it was a tropical island. We thought, wonder where we are now, you see. And some clever dick, he said, I know where we are. And there was a big sign up, welcome to Colombo. So there we were. We'd arrived in Ceylon, and then we were told, I think we were going to do jungle training. This was it, new life. But this Captain Spencer Smith, he had other ideas. He seemed to like me, I don't know why, but he said, would I like to stay with him at command headquarters in Colombo and be his batman, or his officer servant, as he was. And so I said, well, yeah, I doubt if the battalion would allow it. You know, because after all, I am an infantry trained and so on. But anyway, he pulled a few strings, and I stayed in Colombo with Captain Spencer Smith.